Good morning and welcome to the Wednesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Deportation fears silence some domestic violence victims, by Meyer Roden. Since President Trump took office, the hotlines of the Tahira Justice Center in Houston, which advocates for victims of sexual and domestic violence, have been inundated with calls. But the women and men reaching out aren't just reporting instances of abuse. Executive Director Ann Chandler says callers' queries center on one of Trump's biggest domestic priorities, immigration. During routine screening calls, those seeking help, from sex trafficking victims to those escaping abuse, have asked lawyers if they will report them to Immigration and Customs Enforcement. One caller that I was handling, I was simply just trying to coordinate follow-up with that client and explaining that I wasn't going to get to her matter for another week, Chandler recalls. She paused and said, "Are you going to report me to ICE?" In the past 19 years, I haven't had a caller ask me at the end of a conversation. The community is scared. The Trump administration has not made life easy for America's undocumented immigrants. To a large extent, that's by design. One of President Trump's first acts in office was signing a pair of executive orders that beefed up enforcement and expanded the list of deportable offenses. But while Trump has long said he's most interested in criminals and gang members, the immigrant community has interpreted the president's rhetoric and reports of increased enforcement, including the arrest of a woman seeking a protective order in an El Paso courthouse, to mean all are at risk. And that anxiety has translated into behavioral shifts among some of the most vulnerable immigrants, including those trapped in violent situations. A recent survey of over 700 advocates and legal service providers found that 62% have observed an increase in immigration-related questions from survivors of violence. About three-fourths of those surveyed said immigrants have expressed concern about contacting police and appearing in court. "I know that there's a survivor today who is not making the call, or the neighbor who is not making the call to 911," says Chandler. "And I know that because of the phone calls I'm receiving and the client stories that I'm hearing from our attorneys. It's not speculation." Homeland Security Chief John Kelly has said being in the U.S. illegally doesn't necessarily get you targeted. "It's got to be something else," he said. And according to data from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, about 75% of the 41,000 individuals they'd arrested between January and April 2017 were criminals. Yet that same data revealed a 150% increase in non-criminal arrests compared to the same period last year. Kelly says the so-called non-criminals are not innocents. They include multiple deportees and fugitives. 75% are indeed criminals, he said. The other 25% are not the valedictorians of their high school class. But concern about the law has already consumed the community. Libby Haas, a staff attorney at Tahira's Houston branch, says she's heard a lot from a client who is a survivor of sex trafficking, who watches a lot of Spanish-language news and has shown concern about what's happening in the state. "Pretty much every time I've talked to her, she asks if she's going to be deported now," she says. Law enforcement officials are noticing changes, too. As of March in Los Angeles, police reported a 10% drop in reports of domestic violence and a 25% drop in reports of rape among the city's Latinos compared to the year before. The police department noticed no similar drops among other communities of color, and it believes deportation fears may be keeping victims from the Hispanic community from coming forward. Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo noted a 42.8% decline in rapes reported by Latinos compared to the year before, and a 13% drop in all violent crime reported by Latinos. "When you see this type of data and what looks like the beginnings of people not reporting crime, we should all be concerned," Acevedo said. In Texas, Governor Greg Abbott recently signed a controversial law that allows police officers to ask about immigration status during lawful detainment. The law sparked a backlash from police chiefs in major cities who argued the law could make immigrants distrust police and keep them from identifying criminals throughout their communities. It's happened before, says the Migration Police Institute's Muzaffar Christie. Under Arizona's infamous Show Me Your Papers law, he says there was definitely an erosion of trust between communities and police. But Abbott has accused opponents of the law of fear-mongering, insisting that those who have not committed crimes have nothing to fear. The objective of SB 4 is to identify dangerous criminals, not detain hard-working families or innocent children, he wrote in a recent op-ed with the sheriff of Hidalgo County and the McAllen police chief. Officials and activists have promised a summer of resistance in the lead-up to its implementation on September 1st, but the atmosphere is already pretty contentious. Before the Texas legislative session ended, a fight broke out between a Republican and a Democratic lawmaker over the law's protesters. Despite the confusion, victims of crime are still protected under the law. When carrying out the immigration law enforcement mission, ICE remains sensitive to the needs of victims and witnesses of crimes. ICE officers will take into consideration if an individual is the immediate victim or witness to a crime in determining whether to take enforcement action, ICE spokesman Jennifer Elzia says. Particular attention is paid to victims of domestic violence, human trafficking, or other serious crimes. Crime victims and witnesses are also eligible for a special non-immigrant visa, the U visa, which was created specifically for survivors who cooperate with law enforcement. Anna, an undocumented woman from Mexico who survived years of abuse at the hand of her ex-boyfriend, has applied for a U visa. About 2 years ago, she lived with an abusive boyfriend who beat her, raped her, and threatened her life and the lives of her immediate family. He'd punch holes in the walls of their house when he wasn't using his force on her face and body, she says, and warned her that if she went to the police, he'd hurt her young daughters. Anything that I had of value, he would take it away from me, she says. But he also stole my dreams. He stole my hopes. He stole everything. I still live with the impact of that trauma. I still have nightmares. I'm not normal. She sought help from Casa de Esperanza, a Minnesota-based domestic violence advocacy organization. Through Casa, she went to support groups and shared her story. Their lawyers helped her through the process and went with her to court. Now she's anxiously waiting for her visa. She hopes that with it, that she would be able to fulfill her dreams of getting an education and buying a house she can live in with her daughters. Her oldest, age 7, wants to get a dog, too. But she's worried, and she's afraid that women in situations similar to hers, those who don't yet have the strength or resources to walk away, will be worse off than she is. These women are not only afraid of their abuser, but they have more and more fear, she says. You have men who are abusers who feel more empowered to take advantage of their victims. Here's How to Make Yourself Love Exercise by Amanda McMillan. It's not just you. Many people are turned off by the thought of exercise because they think it has to be intense or time-consuming. But the findings of a new study published in the journal BMC Public Health suggests that people could learn to enjoy being active simply by tweaking those beliefs and expectations. So says the study's lead author, Michelle Seeger, director of the University of Michigan's Sport, Health, and Activity Research and Policy Center, who spent years researching what motivates people to get and stay physically fit. She's also author of No Sweat, How the Simple Science of Motivation Can Bring You a Lifetime of Fitness. Too often, she says, people begin exercise programs to lose weight and quit when they don't shed pounds right away. In her new study, she and her colleagues asked 40 women about what really makes them feel happy and successful. Then they analyzed how their views about working out either fostered or undermined those feelings. The diverse group of women were all between ages 22 and 49. All of the women, whether they were regular exercises or not, turned out to want the same things out of life, to have meaningful connections with others, to feel relaxed and free of pressure during their leisure time, and to accomplish the goals they'd set for themselves, whether in their personal lives, their careers, or simply their daily to-do lists. The big difference, the researchers found, was that women who were inactive viewed exercise as counterproductive to those things. In order for exercise to be valid, they thought, it had to be seriously heart-pumping and sweat-inducing, the complete opposite of the relaxing feeling they wanted from their free time. They also felt that following an exercise program took up too much time and put too much pressure on them, and that it was too difficult to commit to a schedule and meet expectations, leaving them feeling like failures. But women in the study who were regularly active didn't share these views. For them, exercise went hand in hand with their desires for social connectivity, relaxing leisure time, and feeling accomplished. That shift in mindset has to happen for women who aren't currently active, says Seeger. These women feel alienated by exercise or feel that they failed when they tried it in the past, she says. They have a very narrow definition of what exercise should look like. Seeger says that definition comes from decades of messaging from fitness companies and older scientific research suggesting that high-intensity activity is the only way for exercise to be worthwhile. That's no longer true, she says. The new recommendations for physical activity really open the door for people to pretty much do anything that works for them. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services suggests that for a substantial health benefit, adults should get 150 minutes a week of moderate intensity physical activity, such as brisk walking. It's true that additional benefits can be gained from more or more intense exercise, but Seeger says this is a good starting point for many Americans who currently lead sedentary lives. Instead of thinking about exercise as an alternative to enjoying free time or socializing with friends, she recommends framing it as a way to make those things happen. Women need to give themselves permission to use physical activity as a way to relax, to get together with friends or loved ones and take a leisurely stroll, simply because being active and outdoors boosts their mood and makes them feel good. While walking is an easy way to squeeze in more movement throughout the day, she also encourages people to get creative. If you liked biking as a kid, rent a bike and see if it still feels good, she says. Play tag with your kids, take a dance class, or even just climb the stairs a few extra times while you're doing chores around the house. Most importantly, Seeger says, people need to know that any physical activity is better than no physical activity. You don't have to do 30 minutes at a time, you don't have to sweat, and you don't have to hate whatever it is you're doing, she says. You just have to choose to move when you see opportunities.
Kabul bombing, a tragic reminder of the deteriorating security situation in Afghanistan. By Nikhil Kumar. Kabul's streets were once again smeared with blood on Wednesday morning, as a powerful bomb exploded in the center of the Afghan capital, killing at least 80 people and wounding more than 300 in a devastating attack near the presidential palace and foreign embassy buildings. The death toll looks set to climb as local hospitals were overrun with casualties from the attack. The epicenter of the blast was a busy section of Kabul near the Arg, the 19th-century fortress that houses the president's home and residence, and close to the German embassy. It was time to coincide with the morning rush hour, when Kabul's roads are packed with cars and traffic in many parts is slow-moving. The blast was so huge that it dug a big crater as deep as 4 meters. General Hassan Shah Frug, Kabul's police chief, told the New York Times, "There is no immediate claim of responsibility for the bombing, which came as Muslims around the world mark the holy month of Ramadan. The Taliban, which has grown increasingly more powerful following the departure of most foreign troops from Afghanistan in 2014, denied that it was behind the attack, according to the Reuters news agency. Earlier in May, 8 civilians died when an ISIS suicide bomber struck a NATO convoy that was making its way through Kabul. Condemning the latest attack on the capital, the Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, said, "Even in this holy month of Ramadan, which is a month of worship, virtue, and blessings, terrorists have no intention to stop killing the innocent people." Throughout the morning, plumes of smoke continued to rise from the blast site, a reminder, in the most tragic way, of the deteriorating security situation in the country more than a decade and a half after U.S.-led forces displaced the Taliban regime from Kabul. In recent years, insurgents and terrorist groups have increasingly gained ground across Afghanistan, with the government's control or influence extending to only about 60% of the districts nationwide. About 13,000 NATO troops remain stationed in the country, among them some 8,400 Americans, who are focused on two missions: training Afghan forces and countering the worsening terror threat. 20 of the 98 U.S.-designated terrorist groups worldwide operate in the Afghanistan-Pakistan region. This is the highest concentration of terrorist groups anywhere in the world, General John Nicholson, the top U.S. commander in the country, told the Senate in February. Wednesday's blast came as the U.S. considers sending an additional 3,000 to 5,000 troops to Afghanistan to help in a war that President Ghani, in an interview with Time in Kabul this month, said mattered for global security. "If I am correct in saying that this is a war over Afghanistan, I would like the American taxpayer to imagine, given that Osama bin Laden alone could do, what if a third, a half, God forbid, or all of Afghanistan is a center of global terrorism incorporated," he said. "The threats, given the way threats operate now, will become much more pronounced." Ghani highlighted the threat from ISIS, which was the target of the so-called mother of bombs dropped by U.S. forces in eastern Afghanistan in April. "I would say hundreds, not thousands, but hundreds that are lethal," he said, when asked about the number of ISIS fighters in the country. "Al-Qaeda," he added, "is also still active in the country. We've eliminated a number of key places, and we've captured a lot of information, but it's not finished by any means," he told Time.
Why that viral video of a newborn baby walking is totally normal, by Amanda McMillan for Health.com. More than 87 million people have tuned in to watch a Facebook video that some say depicts a miracle, a baby appearing to walk with the support of a nurse just minutes after birth. The Daily Mail reports that the woman in the video, which was uploaded Thursday, explains in Portuguese that she was trying to wash the newborn, but that the baby girl kept getting up to walk. The nurse pointed to where she had tried to lay the child down, saying, "She has walked from here to here." The video was reportedly filmed at a hospital in Brazil. Facebook's English translation of its caption reads, "This is amazing. A baby walks just after being born." But while the vision of a tiny infant strolling step by step may look amazing, experts say it's really not out of the ordinary. "This is a totally normal reflex that babies have," says Dr. Megan Heer, assistant professor of pediatrics at Temple University and medical director at Temple's Well Baby Nursery. "If anything, this video really highlights the reflex and is a good example of what normal babies do." Infants have a number of primitive reflexes as soon as they're born. They automatically close their hands to grasp when their palms are stroked, suck when the roofs of their mouths are touched, and throw out their arms when they're startled, for example. The step reflex, also known as the walking or dancing reflex, is what allows babies to take steps when held upright with their feet touching a solid surface. This reflex is present for about the first 2 months of life, Heer says. Daniela Corbetta, Ph.D., director of the Infant Perception Action Laboratory at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, says the stepping reflex has been documented in newborns since the 1940s. The alternating leg pattern shown in the video looks like walking, but really is only a stepping motion, Corbetta told Health in an email. This is very far from being able to walk. Heer says the step reflex can occur when infants are supported by the upper body, which stimulates the weightless environment they experience in the womb. It's up for debate why this reflex occurs, but some experts say it's to develop lower limb muscles that they'll later use for independent and conscious walking, she says. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, babies begin to voluntarily push down with their legs when their feet are on a hard surface around 4 months of age. They may also be able to roll over from their tummy to their back at this time. They begin to sit without support around 6 months, and most can crawl and pull themselves to a standing position while holding on to something by 9 months. By their first birthday, babies may take a few steps unassisted, and most can cruise around a room or walk while holding on to furniture. Anywhere from 9 months up until around 15 or 16 months is normal for walking, as long as the baby is progressing in milestones at minimal intervals, Heer says. In an interesting coincidence, however, one of those milestones may be up for debate. Recent research from the Norwegian University of Science and Technology demonstrates how some babies with specialized training can stand on their own by 4 months of age. A news article published by the university contains fascinating photos and videos of these babies standing unsupported out of the water during a swim class. The results appear remarkable when compared to the expected age required for other forms of independent standing, the authors wrote in Frontiers in Psychology. But while every baby is different, it would be downright impossible for one to take deliberate steps so soon after birth. Besides the fact that infants' brains haven't developed enough for that, they also lack the required muscle strength and coordination. This newborn clearly shows no balance control, Corbetta says. If the nurse were to let go, the baby would fall. Heer says that looking for this and other reflexes is actually part of any normal physical exam for infants, which is one reason it's so important for new parents and babies to attend these regular appointments. As kids get older, she adds, checkups are also important to make sure they're meeting their developmental milestones. It tells us they're developing neurologically as they should be, she says. I often show the parents, look how cute, the baby can grab my hand. The baby can't control it, but it shows that she's normal and healthy. This article originally appeared on health.com. The creator of Android just unveiled a new smartphone, by Lisa Iadicio. Former Google executive and Android founder Andy Rubin is releasing a new smartphone via his recently launched company, Essential. Rubin hopes to differentiate the $699 smartphone from many of its competitors with features like a magnetic port for accessories and a titanium design. The company has not yet announced when the new phone will begin shipping. One of the Essential phone's standout features is a magnetic wireless data transfer feature meant to keep accessories from being made obsolete by new connection standards. The concept is similar to Motorola's MotoMods, custom accessories that attach to certain Motorola phones through a magnetic connector. Essential's first add-ons include a 360-degree camera and a charging dock. For all the good Android has done to help bring technology to nearly everyone, it has also helped create this weird new world where people are forced to fight with the very technology that was supposed to simplify their lives, Rubin wrote in a blog post outlining Essential's goals in developing new gadgets. Essential's smartphone will also include a USB Type-C port like most new Android phones and is powered by a 3040 mAh battery. That's larger than those included in the Galaxy S8 and Google Pixel, but slightly smaller than the Galaxy S8 Plus and Pixel XL's batteries. Essential is claiming that the phone's titanium body won't scratch, dent, or bend. It's so confident of this, in fact, that it's not even selling cases for the device. And like the Samsung Galaxy S8 and LG G6, Essential's phone includes an edge-to-edge screen with nearly invisible bezels, aiming to offer a more spacious display while keeping the device comfortable to hold. The borders around the screen are so thin that it looks like a portion of the display wraps around the front-facing camera. The phone's camera system uses two sensors, one color and one monochrome, resulting in photos with up to 200% more color than the average smartphone camera, says Essential. If the Essentials offering is just as durable and easily customizable as the company claims, it could give manufacturers like Motorola and Samsung some tough competition, but it will have to fully deliver on those promises to stand out in a market that's already largely dominated by giants like Samsung and Huawei, which together account for 30% of smartphone shipments worldwide, according to research firm IDC. Android fans, however, might find plenty to like in a high-end headset without the clutter of other similar phones.
Huge explosion in Kabul's diplomatic area kills at least 80 people, wounds hundreds more. By Rahim Faiz and Amir Shah, AP, Kabul. A massive explosion rocked a highly secure diplomatic area of Kabul on Wednesday morning, killing 80 people and wounding as many as 350. An attack that left a scene of mayhem and destruction and sent a huge plume of smoke over the Afghan capital. The target of the attack, which officials said was a suicide car bombing, was not immediately known, but Ismail Kawasi, spokesman of the Public Health Ministry, said most of the casualties were civilians, including women and children. It was one of the worst attacks Kabul has seen since the drawdown of foreign forces at the end of 2014. Associated Press images from the scene showed the German embassy and several other embassies located in the area heavily damaged in the explosion. It wasn't known if any foreign diplomats were among the casualties, but Germany and Pakistan said some of their embassy employees and staff were hurt in the explosion. The explosion took place at the peak of Kabul's rush hour when roads are packed with work-time commuters. It went off close to a busy intersection in the Wazir Akbar Khan district, said Najib Danish, deputy spokesman for the Interior Ministry. The neighborhood is considered Kabul's safest area, with foreign embassies protected by dozens of 10-foot-high blast walls and government offices guarded by police and national security forces. The German embassy, the foreign ministry, and the presidential palace are all in the area, as are the British and the Canadian embassies. The Chinese, Turkish, and Iranian embassies are also located there. Local TV footage showed shocked residents soaked in blood stumbling about, then being ferried away to hospitals. Passers-by stopped and helped the wounded into their private cars. Others congregated outside the nearby Italian-run emergency hospital. No group immediately claimed responsibility for the blast. Both the Taliban and the Islamic State group have staged large-scale attacks in the Afghan capital in the past. A statement from the Ministry of Interior Affairs says it condemns in the strongest terms the terrorist attack that killed so many, including women and children. These heinous acts go against the values of humanity as well as values of peaceful Afghans, the statement added. These attacks also demonstrate the extreme level of atrocity by terrorists against innocent civilians. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani strongly condemned the attack, which came just days into the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. A statement from his office quoted Ghani as saying that the terrorists, even in the holy month of Ramadan, the month of goodness, blessing, and prayer, are not stopping the killing of our innocent people. Pakistan also condemned the terrorist attack in Kabul this morning that has caused loss of precious human lives and injuries to many. Pakistan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said the blast has caused damage to the residences of some Pakistani diplomats and staff living in the close vicinity and inflicted minor injuries to some. The Foreign Ministry in Berlin said it had no immediate information on possible casualties or damage to the German embassy, but was working on trying to get more details from Afghanistan. Germany has had troops in Afghanistan for 15 years, primarily concentrated in the north, in and around Mazar-e-Sharif. They're currently one of the biggest contributors to the NATO-led Resolute Support mission, with around 980 soldiers on the ground to support and train Afghan security forces. Wednesday's explosion was so heavy that more than 50 vehicles were either destroyed or damaged at the site of the attack. We don't know at this moment what was the target of the attack, said Danish. Residents described a mushroom cloud over Kabul, and windows were shattered in shops, restaurants, and other buildings up to a kilometer, half mile, from the blast site. There are a large number of casualties, but I don't know how many people are killed or wounded, said an eyewitness Gul Rahim. Kawazi, the health official, said the wounded were admitted to different Kabul hospitals. Shortly after the explosion, all roads in Wazir Akbar Khan were blocked off by Afghan security forces and helicopters were deployed over the neighborhood. Last month, the Afghan Taliban announced the beginning of their spring offensive, promising to build their political base in the country while focusing military assaults on the international coalition and Afghan security forces. U.S. and Afghan forces have been battling the Taliban insurgency for more than 15 years. The United States now has more than 8,000 troops in Afghanistan, training local forces and conducting counterterrorism operations. In the past year, they have largely concentrated on thwarting a surge of attacks by the Taliban, who have captured key districts such as Helmand Province, which U.S. and British troops had fought bitterly to return to the government.
Six Super Comfortable Shoe Brands That Business Travelers Love by Martha C. White. Whether you have a calendar loaded with business trips or just an extended summer vacation planned, a comfortable pair of shoes is a must to ease your travels, and flip-flops sometimes just don't cut it. We tapped road warriors, trade show managers, and event planners who regularly face the prospect of looking professional and avoiding aching feet for the brands and styles of footwear they like most. They spilled their secrets, along with the shoes that they wear and sometimes even reorder in bulk. I have a pair of Echoes that are well padded and look nice for work, presenting, walking, etc., says Joan Eisenstadt, a consultant, facilitator, and trainer for the meetings and hotel industry. Translation, she's on the road a lot. Though a little sporty if seen from the back, they look almost like wingtips from the front, and I'd be comfortable wearing for all but the most dressy events, she says. I had two pair. I should have bought more. We tracked down the updated version of Eisenstadt's praiseworthy shoe. The rubber-soled Bluma Ballerina Flat, $100, comes in black and a neutral grayish-gold metallic. It's not just Eisenstadt who's a fan of the ballet flat, which has become the go-to style for women who alternate between flying and lots of walking. I live in ballet flats, says trade show exhibit project manager Candy Adams. As a female, you can wear them with a suit and they don't look out of place. I'm totally into ballet flats, and Easy Spirits is the brand I look for. Avery Ballet Flats, $79 with a slight wedge, are one of Easy Spirits' top-selling dressy shoes, and these on-trend lace-up black Ginata 2 Ballet Flats, $35, are a top pick among Amazon reviewers. In addition to Easy Spirits, a few other brands came up consistently in Road Warrior Wave. One was Clark's, which offer gator-embossed patent pumps as a good option if you want heels. Dansko has great clogs that are favored by many business travelers. Skechers is mostly thought of for sneakers and casual shoes, but its Go Walk line, a few work-appropriate options. Admittedly pricier if somewhat more fashion-forward, Cole Haan shoes also got kudos. In the non-boot season, I travel in a pair of Cole Haan flats and bring a pair of pumps with me, says Hillary Dixon, a digital strategy executive in the financial services industry. I try to keep it pretty simple when I travel. All outfits for the week either have to go with the comfortable pair I wear to travel or I put in, at most, one other pair. Cole Haan says this packable ballet flat in its Studio Grand line, $170, is one of its top sellers across online and brick-and-mortar channels. With a padded sock liner and flexible but still dressy rubber sole, the shoe comes in 8 neutral to pastel shades. Finally, Adam shared a genius shoe traveling hack for long trips. She buys a pair a half a size larger than her usual shoe size and tucks Dr. Scholl's foam shoe inserts inside. As your feet swell in the airplane, you just take the insoles out, she says. This trick lets her go from terminal to trade show without having to stop and rest flight-swollen feet.
Exercise can help prevent Alzheimer's disease by Amanda McMillan for Real Simple. Plenty of studies have shown that exercise is good for the aging brain, but a new scientific review provides the clearest evidence yet. Physical activity is associated with a reduced risk of Alzheimer's disease, the paper concludes, and it may also improve the performance of daily activities for people who already have the disease. But simply moving around every day isn't enough, says lead author Kathleen Martin-Guinness, professor of health and exercise science at the University of British Columbia in Canada. To really reap the benefits of exercise, studies show, older adults need to regularly push themselves to moderate intensity levels. The new review published in the journal BMC Public Health was conducted so experts could form a consensus as to whether physical activity guidelines for older adults, like those set by the World Health Organization and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, were helpful for cognitive health. The recommended activity dose is protective against 20 or so other chronic conditions, says Martin Guinness, but unfortunately there wasn't enough evidence when those guidelines were made to show that exercise could reduce the risk of dementia. Now there is, she says. Martin Guinness and her colleagues reviewed data from more than 150 research articles, some of which examined the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease and some of which looked at quality of life for those who'd been diagnosed. Based on those articles, the panel concluded with great certainty that older adults who are physically active are significantly less likely to develop Alzheimer's disease compared to people who are inactive. It's really exciting to see that it's pretty much watertight at this point, says Martin Guinness. And if we can get that message out there, there might be older adults who are motivated to exercise if they know this is one of the benefits. The research also showed that people who had Alzheimer's disease but remained physically active were better able to get around and function on a daily basis compared to Alzheimer's patients who weren't active. Physical activity may also improve general cognition and balance, Martin Guinness says, although these claims aren't quite as solid. General cognition is the big one people want to know about, she says. While we can't yet say that the evidence is crystal clear, we can say that it's promising. Experts still don't know enough to give a specific exercise prescription for the prevention or treatment of Alzheimer's, but Martin Guinness says that is her ultimate goal. For now, her best advice is for older adults to follow the current guidelines for people 65 and older. That means that older adults who are fit and healthy should get at least 150 minutes of moderate intensity aerobic exercise, such as brisk walking every week and muscle strengthening activities on two or more days. That moderate intensity activity can be swapped for 75 minutes of vigorous activity, such as jogging or running, or a combination of the two. The moderate to vigorous intensity part is important, says Martin Guinness. You can't just go for a leisurely stroll, she says. You do have to be pushing it, getting a little out of breath, so it's challenging to talk to the person next to you. Martin Guinness notes that most of the studies looked at adults with early-stage Alzheimer's, when it was still relatively easy for them to get out and walk or maintain a regular exercise routine. It can be challenging to encourage exercise in loved ones with dementia, she acknowledges, especially more advanced cases. To help with these challenges, she and her colleagues developed a toolkit available on the Ontario Brain Institute's website to help older adults stay safe and get the types of exercise they need. If someone has issues with mobility or balance, for example, they might still be able to get their heart rate up by doing chair aerobics. Any adults with physical health issues should check with their doctors before starting an exercise program, Martin Guinness says. Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia, and the number of worldwide cases is expected to increase from 20.8 million in 2010 to 106 million in 2050. But Martin Guinness says this review can be good news for anyone who's willing and motivated to act preemptively. This article originally appeared at realsimple.com.
How a Soul Cycle Guru Stays Fit on Vacation, by Stacy Griffith. If you're like me, you've been working hard to get into your best shape for summer, looking forward to beach vacations and maybe even a trip abroad. But when we spend time away from our homes and our routines, we risk losing our fitness momentum. I never want the results of all those days of training to disappear from my body, but if I'm not careful, they can, and it happens fast. For me, preparing for vacation is about more than just hitting the gym. I also need to think in advance about how I'll keep up my fitness and balance healthy eating with a few deserved indulgences. Here are my tips on how to stay in shape while on vacation. Keep it structured. If you're the type of person who enjoys finding a local gym or popular studio workout, decide before you leave for your trip when and where you'll work out. If you're going for a class, make sure you secure your spot in advance so you don't have to stress about getting in on the fly. This works for anyone who feels like he or she needs time in a gym. I am not that person. Don't get me wrong, I love a fitness-based vacation. I just did an awesome XPT training trip with Gabby Reese and Laird Hamilton. However, if I'm exploring a place like Paris, you will not find me remotely close to any gym or studio, period. If you're like me, I recommend incorporating fitness into your activities. When I travel, I love to walk around to see the sights and rack up steps on my fitness tracker. Walking burns calories, keeps my metabolism revved up, and when coupled with a full day of drinking water, leaves me feeling great without having to hit the studio for a class. Whenever I'm walking upstairs, I always take them two at a time to engage my glutes more and give my quads an extra little pump. Be sure to bring sneakers on your trip. You will definitely use them. You can squeeze in moments of fitness at unexpected times. Believe it or not, when I stretch in the shower for a couple of extra minutes in the hot water, I get out feeling like I just did a yoga class. Try pumping out a few push-ups against the tile wall, then reaching up for a full body stretch. Or try my favorite neck stretch. Drop your chin to your chest, turn your head slowly to the right, then the left, then back to center, and finally raise your chin up even more slowly, taking a nice, deep, connected inhale. Or, if the place where I'm staying has a bathtub, I like to pick up some bath salts and stretch and soak for 30 to 40 minutes. Be mindful of what you eat and how much you sleep. The bottom line here is that you still have to watch what you eat on vacation. Taking time off is not a license to go crazy with unhealthy food. You can enjoy all the wonders of the local culinary culture while still pacing yourself with treats and sweets. Last but not least, sleep. I never feel better than when I get a great night's sleep. Let your body rest and reinvigorate to be ready for the next day's adventure. Stacy Griffith is a senior master instructor at SoulCycle and the author of the book Two Turns from Zero. Stacy's motivational coaching style combines a passion for dance, athleticism, and mind-blowing music, all set to the beat of her voice. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.